Hey everyone, welcome to the East West Hunting Podcast. When you hear the name Theodore Roosevelt and the words conservation and partnership, those words offer a good deal of inspiration to those of us who love and respect wild places and wildlife and the North American conservation model. When you put those four words together collectively, they become the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, one of the most successful, effective conservation organizations in North America right now. So it's a great pleasure to have with us today Whit Fosberg, President and CEO of the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, also called PRCP. Whit, thanks so much for joining us today. We're absolutely thrilled to have you on the show.
Todd, it's a real pleasure to be on. I really enjoy your podcast, and it's an honor to be with you.
Well, thanks a lot. And you know, we really appreciate all that you do at PRCP to promote conservation, both on public lands and private lands across North America, to promote the legacy of hunting and fishing. So I have to say, you have an incredible coalition of conservation partners. How does TRCP, how have you been so successful in crafting such a wide-ranging group of organizations and individuals to achieve your conservation goals?
Well, you know, Todd, I'm going to sort of go back in, you know, history a little bit, you know, all the way to Theodore Roosevelt, because it was really the sportsmen in this country that created the modern conservation system. You know, stopping the market hunting, you know, creating the public lands network through Theodore Roosevelt, putting in the early environmental laws, creating the funding mechanisms that pay for conservation across the country today. And, you know, it was never, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, it was a very unified, you know, passion. And it was until the 1990s or so, it was not something that was partisan. TRCP was created to sort of reestablish, you know, that centrist voice in conservation because, you know, beginning in the 1930s, you know, we started to have, you know, Ducks Unlimited was created, then Trout Unlimited in the 50s and the Elk Foundation and, you know, Rough Grouse Society, you know, and you name it. There are, you know, two or three different NGOs for every, you know, game species out there. And collectively, our community kind of took the eye off the ball of what was happening in Washington. And the founder of this organization, a guy named Jim Range, in 2002, you know, decided to pull together an organization that brought everyone together that cared about conservation, hunting, and fishing to speak on a common voice on those big issues that are really too big for any one group. Conservation funding, public lands, you know, farm bill, you know, other really big issues that affect, you know, hunting and fishing and conservation in this country, whether people know it or not. And, you know, and Jim had been, you know, a longtime Senate staffer. He had been the chief of staff for Republican, you know, Howard Baker, who was majority leader of the Senate back in the early 80s and late, you know, late 70s. And, you know, Jim, like Baker, were Tennessee boys, cared a lot about conservation, cared a lot about hunting and fishing, and were really part of that generation that, you know, it didn't matter whether you're Republican or Democrat on these issues. These were really just fundamental American issues. And, you know, sort of like any organization that had fits and starts initially, nobody was sure, you know, all the NGOs are obviously, you know, covetous of their own membership, their own funders, you know, they don't really want to work together. You know, we've been this sort of, you know, I think our community tends to be fairly insular looking anyway, you know, so the deer hunters really don't have much time for the bass fishermen, they don't have much time for the fly guys. And, you know, so we've sort of became this, you know, sort of very divided, you know, sort of insular-looking community, and we were losing out in federal policy because you had the emergence of the environmental community, which tended to be pretty left-leaning, litigious, you know, over time got aligned with the Democratic Party. You had, you know, the gun, you know, and sort of more right-wing causes become further and further right and further away from hunting and more Republican in orientation. And that left a great divide in the middle of the folks that really, whose voices weren't being heard. So today we have 58 different NGOs as a part of the partnership. And, you know, your listeners will recognize a lot of them. You know, Ducks Unlimited, Trout Unlimited, BHA, the traditional hunting and fishing groups, Turkey Federation, you know, Rough Grouse Society, American Woodcock Society. But also, you know, Jim recognized that, you know, we had to reach out beyond our, you know, sort of comfy little hunting and fishing community if we really wanted to, you know, hold our ground and to affect change and push through good public policy. So he reached out to the land trust community, Nature Conservancy, Trust for Public Land, Conservation Fund. You know, we've reached out to the Outdoor Industry Association because, That's L.L. Bean and REI and those groups. And they may not agree on 100% of everything, but they care about well-managed public lands and outdoor recreation and conservation funding. You know, AFL-CIO became a member because 70% of their 12 million members hunt and fish. They knew how to organize and they knew how to, you know, mobilize and put pressure on politicians. You know, we've reached out to Hispanic Access Foundation because, you know, our community tends to be pretty much lily white and old and male. And to the extent that we can, you know, sort of get some diversity within it, it's a good thing long term as the demographics in this country change. So that's a very long-winded answer of sort of how we got to the place where we are today. But it seems to be working.
I love it, Whit. That's great. And I love what you said. You're spot on about saying that, you know, when it comes to conservation, these are American issues. They don't have to be Republican or Democrat. And so for conservationists moving forward, you know, broad-ranging partnerships, coalitions, groups of stakeholders, you know, that's all important to getting things done and to unifying a voice. And you folks at TRCP are really nailing it, bringing that together, coalescing into a policy agenda that you can move forward and do good for conservation both now and in the future.
Yeah, and I think one of the keys is that, you know, listen, some of us disagree on things, and that's fine. We just park that stuff at the door, and we'll focus on the, you know, 85% of the stuff we all agree on. And, we can fight about whether you want, you know, wilderness or whether you want managed, you know, public lands or, you know, development or whatever. But, you know, again, that debate is a luxury. And, you know, as long as we still have those public lands, then we can have those debates. And I think we all agree that we want, you know, well-managed, well-funded agencies to do that stuff because it's not free. And if you don't manage it, you know, we're not going to have what we've gotten used to.
Yeah, well said, Whit, and I love it. So, you know, talking about the funding, one of the things that's on everybody's mind right now is the Farm Bill, right? So the Senate has a bill, the House has a bill. What's your take on the Farm Bill right now with updates, and what do you see happening with the bills in both the House and the Senate, and what can our listeners do to help support TRCP move a positive agenda forward?
Well, I mean, the Farm Bill is a really big deal. I mean, you know, the great majority of land in this country is privately owned, and about, you know, half of that land, privately owned lands, are either in, you know, agricultural production or commercial timber production. And so to the extent that we can incentivize private landowners to be better stewards is a good thing. And to the extent that we can incentivize them to open up their land for public hunting and fishing, you know, as we lose access all over the country, you know, that's a really good thing. And the Farm Bill is the single largest source of money for conservation in this country. It's, you know, $4 billion plus. And it affects, you know, 70 million acres out there enrolled in some sort of conservation program. That may mean, you know, just a CRP strip where you're really, you know, trying to restore some native grasses and, you know, cover for, you know, pheasants or quail or whatever it might be, to a program like EQIP, which is, you know, may fund, you know, water quality improvements on, you know, in agricultural lands. So it makes a really big difference. The House, and historically the Farm Bill has been a pretty bipartisan enterprise. It is not broken down on Republican Democratic lines as much as it's broken down on urban and rural lines. And there's always been an alliance between the urban and rural members that the rural members get their farm programs and their conservation programs, and the urban members get their, you know, nutrition assistance, food stamps, you know, that stuff. And that's why you have things like, you know, the nutrition program of the Farm Bill. Now, this year, it is broken down, as much does in Washington these days. And the House, you know, rammed through an incredibly partisan, you know, Farm Bill. You know, did, you know, a lot of sort of social engineering stuff, you know, that, you know, was bound to fail from the beginning in terms of creating, you know, the bipartisan spirit that bill has always had. And so what we've, you know, they finally passed. They couldn't pass it the first time, brought it back up, passed it by two votes on very partisan lines. Now that is waiting for the Senate. And the Senate took a very different approach. It started from the beginning, you know, really reaching out across the lines, coming up with a reasonable program that, you know, both sides could support, and it passed overwhelmingly, 85 votes. And so that's what the Senate has. On the conservation side, you know, the House, both of them are pretty good bills. The House reduces funding a little bit over what we had before. We want to get that back up. But I think that because the the Senate passed such a bipartisan bill, that is really going to be, you know, what I think most folks will see as the final solution on this thing. And I suspect that when you go to conference, you will see something coming out of it that looks more like the Senate side. Now, in terms of what folks can do, is they can contact their, you know, members of Congress, their senators, their congressmen, and say, you know, that, you know, do not cut conservation in this farm bill. When we passed the last farm bill in 2014, it was a very different time economically. The, you know, corn prices, soybean prices were at record highs. There was minimal interest out there getting into conservation programs because it was just so profitable to plow up everything. And today it's very different. We have really low commodity prices. Farmers out there are clamoring to get into these programs. And this is the last time that we ought to be, you know, reducing, you know, conservation, because there's way more demand than there is program right now. And this is something that helps farmers stay on that land until those prices rebound at some point. And you're starting to see with the trade war that's going on right now, you know, soybean prices are dropping even further. And that means that we really need these conservation programs as a way that, you know, farmers can enroll their lands in this stuff and get paid something, and then, you know, wait it out until they have better prices. So it's a good time for conservation. I think the House and the Senate bills both have pretty good titles in terms of conservation, but the bottom line is do not cut funding for conservation.
Yeah, that's a good message, Whit. And it's really interesting how, you know, the vacillations in the commodity markets impact all that, what you were talking about with commodity pricing for beans and crops and stuff like that. And, you know, the critical play that conservation like CRP and stuff can play to keep that habitat intact for farmers and to keep it as working land. And, you know, you know that I live up in the Adirondacks, and you're talking about the need for, you know, both public land stewardship out there, but private land stewardship and the importance of that. And, you know, like we do, I'm in the forestry business, so I'm a consulting forester by my day job. And like the EQIP programs are vitally important for incentivizing private landowner clients. You know, you were talking about water quality, also just from a forest management standpoint, getting them enrolled in stewardship plans and getting them enrolled in habitat plans and all that stuff. So it all plays into each other. You know, you have public lands, you have private lands, everything has to be working together in order to keep everything healthy for conservation. So,
well, that's exactly right. And we're at a sort of a time in, you know, sort of political history where, you know, nobody really seems to like regulation. And, you know, we see that at EPA and even at USDA. There's not a lot of, you know, appetite out there for going and enforcing things. So if you're not going to do that, then you better double down on the incentives to encourage people to do the right things, or else you're just going to have a gradual decline in water quality, habitat quality, you name it. And, you know, so I just think that it just makes a ton of sense right now to be investing in things like that, you know, forestry titles of the farm bill, the conservation titles, and, you know, stuff that really incentivizes landowners to do the right thing so you don't have to come down on them with the regulatory side.
Makes a lot of sense, Whit. So, yeah, thanks for providing a good overview there. I really appreciate that. So let's talk a little bit. You know, Mike Lee's in the news right now. That's he, senator from Utah. He's ramped up his rhetoric about public lands transfers and everything like that. What's your interpretation of all that? Who's he trying to message here? What's he doing? Is he just lobbing, you know, shots over our bow as conservationists? Is he trying to rally his base? What's going on? And what do we need to be doing as far as, you know, trying to engage to have a positive outcome for public lands on that side of things?
Well, I think you have to take it seriously. You know, Senator Lee has a long history of being, you know, pretty far to the right and pretty anti-environment. You know, generally, he's, you know, sort of part of the, you know, generally referred to as, you know, the Freedom, you know, Caucus, you know, in the Congress, you know, Tea Party. And he has made no secret that he is no friend of public lands or conservation. And, you know, a lot of the times you can just sort of laugh this stuff off, but you have a senior member of the dominant party, one that controls the Senate. And he was one of the guys who was being rumored before last night to be, you know, a pick for the Supreme Court. I mean, he is a credible guy. And if he proposes, says he's going to put in three different bills to basically get rid of public lands or to industrialize them or both, then you have to take that seriously. And the problem with our community is that, you know, in the past, you know, these things come up and down. You know, remember during Reagan, we had the Sagebrush Rebellion. And then, you know, later on in the 90s, we had the Shovel Brigade, where a bunch of clowns in Nevada went out and reopened a Forest Service road to an outhouse. And it became sort of a national cause celeb. Then you have the Bundys. Yeah, but the difference right now is that, you know, this anti-public lands movement is not going to go away. It is well-funded. There are a lot of, you know, sort of very right-wing, you know, dark money operations that are putting money into this. You know, so it is not a coincidence that you have guys like Lee out there proposing that we really ought to be just getting rid of public lands and, you know, and selling them off. And he, you know, gave this impassioned speech before a conservative group where he equated, you know, kind of nonsensically, you know, with the our public land system with feudal England, where the nobility had the lands and then the peasants and the others starved because they couldn't get on them. Well, what he doesn't seem to understand is the exact opposite in this country. You know, we looked at England. We didn't want that model. So we have a public lands network of 600 million plus acres that everybody can get onto. You mentioned the North American model. You know, fundamental to that core is that everybody has a right to hunt and fish in this country, not the landed gentry. The wildlife belong to the people, not to the landowner, not to the state, not to the corporation, not to the federal government. And, you know, so it is about as egalitarian a system as you could possibly have. And you look at a place like Utah, and we have this on our website, trcp.org, and I did a blog on it. You know, they sold over 200,000 resident hunting licenses last year. They sold about 30,000 non-resident. So it's not like the people of Utah aren't out there using and enjoying their public lands. And every statistic out there shows that public land communities, communities against public lands by them, are more profitable than ones that are isolated from them, because those public lands draw people. And you look at a place like Bozeman, Montana today, and it is booming. You have all these companies that moved in there because it's a gateway to Yellowstone. It has all these public lands. It has great rivers for fishing. And, you know, but just that is lost on a lot of these politicians, particularly from the West, that see this as a winning political issue, railing against the federal government and promising people they can get rich if we can just get rid of that pesky federal government and those laws that govern public lands.
I completely agree with, I mean, well said with what you said there. I mean, it just scares the heck out of me anytime I hear talk like this from somebody like that. I agree that it's a huge threat. And as a public landowner who cares about America's public lands, cares about the future of how that shakes out for our kids and grandkids, you know, it just scares the heck out of me. So it's great to hear what you have to say there about the public lands. And I really like what you said about, you know, the fact that for one, Utah in that specific situation, you've got a lot of residents using those lands. This is not, you know, feudal England. It's about as egalitarian as it gets. It benefits people. And you know, I was at the Outdoor Industry Association press conference that you were at last year in April in 16, down at the National Press Conference when OIA, you know, announced their numbers for this economic impact for public lands. It was something like $887 billion or something like that.
It'd be the third largest economic sector in this country behind, I think it's the healthcare and the finance sector.
Yeah.
So, but because we're so dispersed, we don't get the recognition of how important it is economically. We're kind of, oh, you're just fun. You pat us on the head and go and industrialize it.
Yeah, that's right. And I think what's happened is in the past, just kind of like what you're talking about, the hunting and fishing community and kind of how you've coalesced together through TRCP, but you have a big industry that's kind of fragmented and made up of a lot of small industries, right? A lot of small businesses and a lot of small communities and stuff like that. And so you didn't have that cohesiveness, so to speak, in the power of the voice. But with organizations like yourself, like with TRCP, with organizations like I support, like Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, that and other outdoor recreational groups, OIA, you start consolidating this voice and consolidating, you know, the leadership to be able to stand up and you know, voice the importance of public lands and conservation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the old arguments here in Washington about, you know, wildlife and the environment, they just don't work anymore. And I mean, they work with some folks, but a lot of folks just, We have a much more urban Congress than we used to. They don't get hunting and fishing. They don't really care about wildlife. You can get a zoo nearby and go see it there. And what they do care about are jobs and economic impact. And if you can go to somebody and say, you know, look, this is the number of jobs that are in your district, and this is, you know, the taxes these people pay. And by the way, these are jobs never going to get shipped to China. You know, they're here to stay. When you have a guiding operation or a canoe livery or something like that, you know, that's going to be there. And you don't want to kill that golden goose. And I think that, you know, Congress, I think OIA has done a really good job of getting that message out. And their most recent report, you know, breaks it down by congressional district. And you can go on the Outdoor Industry Association website and, you know, download and figure out exactly in your congressional district how much hunting, fishing, recreation, you know, brings in and how many jobs it employs. And that is really the way we need to argue these things in D.C. at least these days, because, you know, the traditional arguments that it's good for the environment just don't resonate as well.
Yeah, well, that's right. And so I like that. And so what I'm going to do for folks for listening, those listening, I'm going to put that link to OIA in the show notes when we publish this, Whit. So that's a great resource. It's good to have on a congressional district level. So thanks for, you know, offering that resource. That's great. Another funding item that's on everybody's radar right now is Land and Water Conservation Fund, which is expiring at the end of September. What's going on with that in your mind, like your interpretation of things? What do you anticipate with LWCF and, you know, similar conversation about what people can do to, you know, to make sure that gets permanently authorized and securely funded?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you raised it because it's a big deal down here. And just for your listeners that don't know much about it, Land and Water Conservation Fund was authorized in the 1960s. And it was part of a deal with opening up the Outer Continental Shelf for oil and gas development. In exchange for opening that up, they decided to earmark $900 million every year for conservation. And it would go into this fund, Land and Water Conservation Fund, and then go out to, you know, the states for parks, go to, you know, acquisitions to expand or, you know, buy in holdings and some of our federal lands. And it's been incredibly successful. I mean, arguably it's been one of the most successful programs we've had, and especially in a place like the East where we are, you know, kind of challenged for public access a lot of the time. And so those Land and Water Conservation Fund dollars have done a tremendous amount in terms of protecting places that were under threat from sprawl, as well as opening up areas for public access, including hunting and fishing. Montana, I think the stat I heard was that more than 70% of the, you know, fishing access sites in the state were acquired through LWCF funds. And it's often sort of, you know, people think, oh, that's just sort of an environment, you know, program that's locking stuff up. And that's just nonsense. I mean, you know, it is a key sportsman's program. And, you know, a lot of what Land and Water Conservation funds today are easements, you know, just keep working lands working, but not to see them developed and to open up public access. So that program was created and it's been very successful. But the problem was when it was created, there was the money was not guaranteed. So every year the oil and gas industry pays into the fund. Only one year in the past 54 years or whatever it is has been in existence has Congress actually, you know, kicked out, appropriated that $900 million. On average, it's somewhere in that $300 to $400 million range, which is still legitimate money, but not nearly as much as $300 to $400 million was in 1965. So we have an issue of the money has not been given by Congress the way it was supposed to. And then two, you know, the program, you know, runs out this year and needs to be reauthorized by Congress. And so we have until September 30th, you know, to have people weigh in with their legislators saying to reauthorize this program. And then at the same time while they're doing that, you know, actually have their legislators put the money into it that they were promised to put into it in the 1960s. And, you know, listen, if it doesn't get reauthorized by September 30th, there are plenty of programs in this, you know, town and, you know, government that, you know, have expired and still get funded and still get used. But it gives the opponents of Land and Water Conservation Fund and the opponents of public lands, like Mike Lee, an extra leg to stand on saying we should not be funding unauthorized programs like this. And so we want to see it authorized and we want to see it funded.
Absolutely. And you know, in New York, some of the trademark public land places that we have, the Finger Lakes National Forest, the Montezuma National Wildlife Refuge, Sterling Forest, and even Theodore Roosevelt's birthplace in Manhattan. You know, all of that is made possible by LWCF funds. So there's plenty of places in each state, every county has benefited from LWCF. And the way the funding works, it really it doesn't cost the taxpayers a single cent, right? I mean, it's coming from excise taxes on offshore oil and gas. And so, you know, these
right.
are...
Right, you're exactly right, Todd. This is, you know, ideal. We're developing a non-renewable resource, then we ought to invest some of that profits into protecting renewable resources. And that was the, you know, the idea back in 1965, and it still makes a ton of sense today.
It sure does, Whit. So, So for the listeners out there, contact your representatives, ask them to permanently authorize the Land and Water Conservation Fund and have secure funding, full funding, and, you know, it's going to benefit everybody, both hunting and fishing enthusiasts and all public landowners. So, thanks for that, Whit. So let's talk a little bit. You know, when we talk about public lands and the whole debate, you know, it tends to kind of gravitate to Western public lands because of, I think because of the fact that that's where the there's a big threat, you know, with people like Mike Lee out there in the West. And that's where most of the public lands are located. But we have a lot of public lands here in the East, right, that were enabled by the, I think it was the Weeks Act in the 20th century. So, can you talk a little bit about what your thoughts are on policy for Eastern National Forests and public lands and any issues you see and maybe any recommendations or projects that TRCP is working on right here on the East Coast?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think actually a lot of us that live on the East Coast, you know, appreciate public lands even more than people live in the West because we have so few of them. And you go out to the, you know, if you live in D.C., you have, you know, there's a whole swath of public lands right along the river that is used, Potomac River, that is heavily used, you know, for fishing, for biking, for hiking, even for camping. And you go out to the Shenandoah National Forest or the Great Smokies National Park. In your part of the woods, I mean, there are a lot of more state, you know, lands in the East as well. So you have the Adirondacks and the Catskills in New York, you know, which are, you know, we have a lot of, you know, state game lands in the state of Pennsylvania. And these are really heavily used areas that are ecologically really important too. Now, we don't have the same threat in the East about these lands being sold off for development because, you know, everybody recognizes these are real assets that, you know, the folks like. There are a few issues that do face me. One is access. We have, as demographics change and as, you know, before you could just, you know, walk across, you know, some farmer's field to get to a national forest and go hunting. You know, now that land is posted, it may be turned into a condo development, and it's just harder and harder to access the lands that we have. And then we also have a situation where, you know, a lot of the, you know, federal lands, the national forests in the East, the Green Mountain National Forest, the, you know, White Mountain National Forest, you know, some of the, you know, George Washington around here, you know, we have had, because of the, you know, sort of a ripple effect from a lot of the land management fights we've had in the West in terms of logging, you know, there is very little active management being done, and honestly, it needs to be done more. I mean, not only for things like rough grouse and woodcock that want early successional habitat, but also because, you know, as you know, as a forester, you know, we're seeing this movement of invasive, you know, pests, you know, through our forests in the East, and if you're not managing them, you're just not going to have those forests around for very much longer. I mean, you have the emerald ash borer, you know, which is taking out the ash, you know, across the East. I mean, we have, you know, in the Adirondacks, you have the beech blight, you know, that has really created a, you know, sort of a sub, you know, a young beech diseased monoculture in the forest because the deer don't like to eat them, and they, you know, reproduce like crazy as they're diseased, and they outcompete everything else. And, you know, if you're not going to go in there and manage some of these areas, you're just not going to have a vibrant forest for that much longer, and management has, in a lot of places, is a dirty word these days. And we're trying to get that changed. I think we finally made some progress this year in Congress with the, you know, the fix to the, you know, there had been a fire borrowing issue in terms of how we pay for forest fire, you know, prevention out West. And we got that fixed, and along with it, some, you know, modest, you know, forestry reforms that make it easier to go out there and get the wood out of national forests without, you know, sort of opening the door to massive clear cuts again, like we saw in the 1980s. So I think some of that stuff's going to help. But I don't really think it's the sportsmen that need to be engaged in a lot of those issues where you have national forests in the East and you really want to have some active management, and you're going to have a certain contingency out there that opposes cutting any tree at all. And we just need to make our voices heard to say that this is not a bad thing. This is a good thing.
I love it, Whit. Yeah, I agree. And so, you know, with my background being in forestry, I pay attention to a lot of that stuff and understand the importance of active forest management. You know, interestingly, in New York, we were talking about the Adirondacks and the Catskills, which are forest preserve. We have this mosaic of private lands within the Adirondack Park Blue Line. You know, for listeners that aren't familiar with the Adirondack Park, it's 6 million acres within the Blue Line. It was established in the late 1800s. There's about 2.6 million acres of forest preserve, and then the remainder balance is in private land. So you have this kind of unique conservation experience of both public lands and private lands. And the importance of managing the private lands for healthy forests can't be overstated. And, you know, interestingly, I like the Young Forest Initiative in New York. That's a state level program that's not occurring in the forest preserve areas of the Adirondacks and the Catskills. But Young Forest Initiative is a habitat program where, you know, the state with partners from like Cornell and ESF's College of Environmental Science and Forestry are looking at some of the state wildlife management areas and trying to set a goal of, you know, 10% of young forests cover on some of those lands outside of the forest preserve. So they're recognizing that, you know, both from a habitat standpoint. And like you said, the invasives and you know, I just read yesterday, emerald ash borer, you know, they found it over in Maine. And so it's spread from kind of west to east over the years. And, you know, it's a real threat. And I think the economic impact there for the Maine's ash resource is something like $320 million. I mean, it's millions of dollars at risk, you know, from a timber value standpoint, but also from a healthy forest ecosystem standpoint, right? So if we start losing these species, they all play an ecological role in these natural forests. And so you start tinkering with that stuff. You have hemlock woolly adelgid. You know, those hemlocks along the streams, they're promoting and protecting, you know, key riparian areas for trout. So nothing is in a bubble, and all of that comes back to influencing habitat and ultimately hunting and fishing.
Yeah, exactly right. And I mean, New York in a lot of ways has been a leader, you know, both in terms of, you know, the obviously you talk about the state management, which is, you know, you have that mosaic in the Adirondacks and the Catskills, which is so important. And they're trying some other stuff on the other state lands. But they also have the, you know, what they call the 480A tax program in the state that basically gives, you know, landowners an 80% tax break if you're engaged in, you know, basically active management and commercial timber. And so it's created a real incentive for private landowners, you know, to get in there and actually, you know, come up with a management plan and, you know, manage some of these lands. So, listen, I think New York does actually a really good job in general on a lot of this stuff, and some of the other states, you know, are probably lag a little bit. But no, you're right, because we need that mosaic of habitat. You know, listen, I love the old growth in the Adirondacks and the Catskills and go into that, but also I love, you know, some of that new growth where you can go in and, you know, find grouse, you know, some of the other species.
Yeah, that's right, Whit. Well said. And you know, the 480A, it is a good program. It helps maintain forest cover. It helps maintain working forests. It's like an incentive program, just like you were talking about with the farm bill, but it's on a state level. They were, you know, the governor was working on some reforms for that earlier this year. That did not get passed through. They were trying to streamline it a little bit, but that, you know, just kind of got held up with the towns and villages, you know, but it's something that it's still a very effective program. It helps people maintain forest cover in areas where otherwise you might see some, you know, fragmentation and development. So it's a great program, and it gets a lot.
Well, it also helps, you know, maintain, you know, a lumber source for the mills. So you have, you know, where a lot of the Northeast, all the mills have shut down, you still actually have some in the Adirondacks.
Yeah.
And, you know, that, you know, vices it. So that's, you know, then that's part of it because we've incentivized, you know, continued cutting.
Yeah, it's all part of it, right? And so, and I can't emphasize enough the fact that, you know, in forestry, you do need markets. And so if you don't have markets, it makes it a lot tougher to do active forest management. So if you have mills, low-grade mills where you can do active forest management and scientific-based forestry, it makes all the world a difference. You go over to Maine right now, you know, the pulp mills industry is in a flux. A lot of pulp mills have shut down. There's high energy costs, and that's all going to, you know, it's all going to go back to the land eventually. And so if you can't move products, if you can't do low-grade and good management, you know, it's going to impact habitat ultimately.
Yep, you're exactly right.
So, okay, so that's great. So let's talk a little bit. We're covering a lot of ground here, different topics. This is great stuff. Let's talk a little bit about what you see as a spotlight for the East right now. So, you know, if you had to look at Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, general types of issues, we talked about invasives. You want to talk a little bit about CWD or menhaden or anything like that that you might find?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think chronic wasting disease is going to be a huge one. And it's not just Northeast, it's everywhere. I mean, chronic wasting disease first popped up in the U.S. in the 1960s in a game farm in Colorado. And since then, I think it spread to 25 different states, almost, fully through the movement of live deer with the captive servant industry. And in New York has been, a leader in really fighting back against that. It came in there and they really aggressively went after it and, killed a bunch of deer and quarantined the area and, do a little bit better job with the testing and surveillance in a lot of the other states and really seemed to have sort of stopped it in its tracks there. But Pennsylvania, on the other hand, they're moving deer all over the place and it is, becoming, almost ubiquitous in that state at this point. I mean, chances are if they had more money for surveillance and testing, they'd find that it's a lot further than they think it is right now. But, that is, I think, a real threat. And, in what basically CWD is, mad cow disease for deer. And if it ever jumps from, deer to humans, it'll effectively be the end of hunting in this country. Because, 80% of the hunting industry in the U.S. is, deer and deer, elk, moose. And if we lose that, then we lose the, not only the hunting, but we also lose the what pays for conservation in this country. So when you buy your ammo or you buy your gun, you're paying a 10 or 11% excise tax that pays for conservation. The 80% of the, state fish and game agencies are paid for either by the, Pittman Robertson, Dingell Johnson funds, the excise taxes, or through license sales to sportsmen in those states. And if all of a sudden people, stop going hunting, stop buying guns, stop buying ammo, it has huge ripple effects. And, we've seen an area like, I live in D.C., where clearly you don't have hunting and you have huge deer problems. I mean, getting hit by cars, all over the place in people's yards. And they have snipers in Rock Creek Parkway trying to take them out. Well, imagine what it would be like if, people stopped hunting. What would happen to white-tail deer populations? I mean, they would go crazy. And, so there are huge ripple effects with that. And the problem is that right now it's the captive deer industry that's calling the shots. They're trying to weaken the already weak standards of the Department of Agriculture in terms of, captive deer industry. And if that happens, we are going to be in a world of hurt on this thing because, we're letting, sort of the tail wag the dog on this, a relatively small, captive deer industry, which has got some, fine actors in it, but it's also got a lot of bad actors in it. And, they are truly threatening this resource, the golden goose of, hunting and whitetail deer hunting in particular. In America.
That's right, Whit. And, I was on your website here earlier this week and TRCP has a blog about this, right? And it was recent. And, for the listeners, I'm going to put the link in the show notes, but I thought there was a lot of good commentary there about kind of debunking some of the myths around CWD and, it's a complex issue, right? It's called chronic wasting disease and it is chronic and not acute. And so that can kind of lead people to be somewhat complacent or skeptic about this stuff. This is no laughing matter. It can devastate, the deer herds. It can devastate our North American conservation model. And it's so widespread. White-tailed deer are at the heart of North American hunting. And it goes back to habitat too. Everything's related, right? So, deer populations impact habitat, which, it's a full circle.
Oh, yeah. Well, and part of the problem is that the deer industry has spent a lot of money on, or the captive deer industry, I should say, on basically spreading misinformation on this. And, a lot of hunters, want to believe that it's not an issue. And so they see, some guy with a PhD next to his name who's been paid a lot of money to say that this is not a problem and it's never going to be a big deal and it's been around forever. That's what they want to believe because they don't want to change the way they've done business. They don't want to think about, how do I, bone out an animal in the field and take out the meat without, dragging it back and transporting it two states away and possibly spreading that disease? So, we need to get our act together too, and that's the hunting community, and take this seriously and figure out what needs to be done and support our state agencies that are trying to do the right thing on this.
Yeah, and I, you know, I'm monitoring things in New York here, and it sounds like Ag and Markets are working with DEC to promote awareness on CWD. I think New York's done a pretty good job. And New York was one of the areas where I think there was, at one point, there was a case out in maybe Oneida County, and then it's like one of the few areas where I think it actually kind of disappeared. But being right on the cusp of Pennsylvania's border, you know, it's kind of like the invasive species with forest pests. I mean, sooner or later, that stuff's just going to cross the border, and it can be a huge, huge issue.
Oh, yeah. No, and every time, you know, listen, some guy in New York State has, you know, belongs to a hunt camp down in Pennsylvania, has been in the family for generations, and they go down there, and they, you know, whack their, you know, 1.5-year-old whitetail and bring it back home and butcher it in, you know, central New York and put the carcass out in the woods or in landfill, you know, that alone has potential to spread the disease. So we just have to be a part of the solution here. We can't be part of the problem. And a whole lot more needs to be done. We need more money for surveillance and for research. You know, Cornell right now, you know, is one of the leading research institutes, you know, in the country on this issue. And Kristen Schuler out there is our lead researcher on CWD, is an absolute rock star. You ought to get her on your podcast sometime. But, you know, listen, we need to support the agencies and, you know, get the money to control this thing and not let the tail wag the dog in terms of the captive deer industry, you know, loosening controls on moving animals or fencing or anything else.
Absolutely. I completely agree with. So, you know, it's an important topic. It has monumental impacts and effects here. So we need to be paying attention and we need to be monitoring it and funding those types of situations. Anything else going on in the East right now that...
Yeah, you mentioned menhaden, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And menhaden is basically, it's a fish. It's also called bunker. It's called pogey in the Gulf. And it's essentially what everything else eats. So it is the primary diet for striped bass and bluefish and weakfish on the East Coast. And, you know, as, you know, the menhaden go, so go all the predators. And that includes whales and bald eagles and osprey and all the rest. Back in the turn of the century, back in the early 1900s, there was a massive reduction fishery up and down the East Coast. They would catch these menhaden in nets, grind them up, turn them into fish meal, you know, fish food, things like that. It basically, you know, over time, every state except Virginia outlawed that. Virginia now has, you know, 90% of the market for menhaden. We had one company called Omega, which sends, you know, big boats out and scoops it all up and grinds it up and turns it into fish food that it sends to Canada to basically feed pen-raised aquaculture salmon, which is another, you know, ecological nightmare. Mm-hmm. So this is a real lose-lose for sportsmen, you know, along the East. And what we're trying to do, we finally got some, you know, harvest controls put in a few years ago in menhaden, and those are likely to be expanded, you know, in the next couple of years. The one industry, Omega, which is now owned by a company called Cook, is fighting that hard. And to get that, and they're putting a whole lot of political pressure on states up and down the East Coast. And you know, the time is going to tell. Then this, you know, summer, you know, the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, which regulates this on the East Coast, is going to basically have to find, is going to find that Virginia is out of compliance with the new rules about reduced harvest. And, you know, then Virginia will, could be, then it goes to the Department of Commerce, and then Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross will hopefully do what he should do, which is then shut down or dramatically reduce the reduction fishery in Virginia. But there is significant fear that he will basically turn a blind eye and, you know, not agree to find Virginia out of compliance and allow this to be overfished. And that sends a terrible precedent up and down the coast in terms of, you know, proper management. If the council, which is looking at this, can rule one way, and then the Secretary of Commerce can overrule them, on not on behalf of conservation, then that is, you know, very troubling. Not just for striped bass and bluefish and weakfish, but for really the integrity of our, you know, coastal management system. So you can, again, you can go on our website and find out more about this. But every governor on the East Coast is going to have a say in this, and so folks from Maine all the way down to Florida, you know, we're going to need them to weigh in, and we're putting together a dedicated website on this issue right now. But we got a bunch of stuff on our site already if folks want to learn more about it. But they need to engage. If you like to fish in the ocean, catch striped bass, then you need to care about this issue.
Yeah, absolutely, Whit. So, yeah, we'll point people to your website. Now, interestingly, I'm reading a book right now by H. Bruce Franklin, who's a professor at Rutgers of American Studies. He wrote a book about 10 years ago called The Most Important Fish in the Sea, which talks about menhaden. And for listeners out there, you know, it's a good book to read if you want a good background on menhaden. And you know, interestingly enough, the northern neck of Virginia, Reedville, Virginia, by weight is like the third largest fish port in the country, or at least was at the time that book was written. So, you know, you're talking yep. about the omega industry. It's just absolutely huge. The other point he brings up is the fact that, you know, menhaden are an important forage fish for bluefish and stripers and everything like that. But they're also like the liver of the Chesapeake Bay. So like they eat phytoplankton. And so they're filtering through their gill plates. You know, they've got these filters. And so they're eating phytoplankton, which is like algae and stuff like that. So they're cleaning the water. So you have a situation where they're filtering like 4 to 8 gallons per minute of water, and you take millions of fish, and you have a situation with the Chesapeake where you might get nutrient loads from, you know, farming or something like that upstream. And so not only is it an important forage fish, but it's just a crazy important thing for water quality. So that's a cool book.
You're exactly right. It's a great book. I mean, it really, I think, makes you popularizes it. It's not scientific. It really explains it very layman's terms. And your point about them being filter feeders is exactly right, especially as we're, you know, we see algal blooms and now in the Chesapeake Bay, we're seeing them off the coast of Florida really badly right now. And any place where you have, you know, sort of farm country that goes into those estuaries, you're going to see these algal blooms, especially as things get warmer. And we need these fish out there for all sorts of ecological reasons.
Yeah. And you know, I was driving down through Saranac Lake yesterday. I was in the truck and listening to NPR. And Fresh Air at noon, Terry Gross had a guy named Paul Greenberg, and he is an author of a book called The Omega Principle, and he was talking about all this stuff. So he kind of takes it a step further about, like, talking about the demand for fish oil products and stuff like that. So it was just a really cool, probably 15-minute interview on NPR as recently as yesterday, and I'll try to track that down, put that in the show notes.
Good, good. I've not listened to that. It'd be good to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. So any thanks so much. I mean, so this is a great conversation. We're coming in almost on an hour already. So there's just you had a lot of good information to share with us. We really appreciate this. So, you know, in the past, like you were on the Meat Eater podcast with Stephen Ranella several months ago. That's one of my favorite episodes. You talked about the Adirondacks and maybe some Adirondack hunting. Do you have any plans this fall to come up and hunt in the Adirondacks?
Oh, yeah. Now, that's the one week of the year that's absolutely inviolate. My staff all knows that, you know, that, you know, the second week of November, you know, I am not going to be found. I'm not going to answer emails. I'm not going to answer return phone calls. And that's when we do deer camp up there. And, you know, it's my dad and his brother did it before. My brother comes in and we have a couple buddies and we always hunt with. And, yeah, we'll occasionally kill a buck or two. Last year was a good year for us, but there were a bunch of years where, you know, we never see a buck in the course of a week and hunt in the Adirondacks. But it's still the, you know, the best week of the year, and it's you know, tremendous fun, and it's just there's so much history, and you see so many other cool things when you're in the woods up there, marten and fisher and bear and otters, and it's just you know, even if you're not seeing the bucks and you always want to see the bucks, it's never, you know, a bad week. Nope, I'll be doing that, and can't wait.
Yeah, that sounds, it's so much fun. So, you know, I hunt up here. You know, I love it. I grew up up here. This is where I cut my teeth. I everything that you said is spot on, you know, as far as just enjoying the experience of it. There's easier places to hunt here, but this is such a cool experience for being in the East, to be able to get out in the big woods and, you know, just enjoy it. And you know, the cool thing about this is that you're kind of right in the neck of the woods with where, you know, the history of where Theodore Roosevelt was located when he became president, right? He was up in Newcomb hiking on Mount Marcy, and he traveled down to, you know, the North Creek area and eventually went to Buffalo. But there's just such a cool connection there with the Adirondacks to Theodore Roosevelt and back to what TRCP is doing. It's kind of a fun.
Yeah, no, you think about it when you're out there, because honestly, it probably hasn't changed that much. I mean, we have, you know, if anything, there's probably a little bit more mature forest now than there was back then. But it is pretty darn wild and remote, and you don't hear airplanes, you don't hear cars, and you think about what it was like, because, you know, just how it formed Roosevelt. You know, obviously there, Maine, North Dakota, were all, you know, part of what, you know, made him the man he became. You know, that time he spent outdoors and challenging himself in nature and, you know, sort of looking for an animal. And, you know, it's hard not to think about that when you're out there, you know, sitting in the base of a tree in the rain and sleet and wondering what you're doing.
Yeah, that's a fact, you know, and I'd like to think that it influenced him. And so, all right, Whit, so good luck this fall. You know, keep us posted and enjoy the woods. And thanks for everything that you do for conservation. Thanks to TRCP for, you know, for what you guys are doing and gals are doing to promote conservation for all Americans, you know, on the public land side, on the private land stewardship side. You know, for folks that want to go and support TRCP, make donations, go to your website. It's trcp.org, right? And
that is correct.
Okay. So, Whit, thanks for your time. Hope we can do this again sometime. Really appreciate the information and keep up the great work.
Todd, thank you. Maybe we'll connect in the Adirondacks sometime.
I certainly hope so. Thanks, Whit.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on this week's episode of East to West Hunting Podcast. If you like what you hear, please check out our website, www.eastwesthunt.com. We're a community of hunters and anglers and conservationists. Feel free to join our Facebook group as well. It's East to West Hunting.